From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
A massive database is being developed in Florida that will contain detailed information on the lives of American citizens, and showing that law enforcement must be watching science fiction movies. They've called this system Matrix, just like the movie.
Yes, the Matrix is a reality, a Florida police surveillance system that combs through both criminal and commercial records is about to go national. It's run by the same people who started Database Technologies, the company that scrubbed Florida's voter rolls, disempowering thousands of African Americans. We'll speak with Greg Pallas, the investigative reporter of the BBC. And the Taliban are back. The suppression of women is increasing. Drug market is flourishing. We'll take a look at Afghanistan almost 2 years after the U.S. started bombing. Then we go to Bolivia. The U.S. pressured the Bolivian government to declare war on coca and the people who grow it. Evo Morales, the first coca grower to be elected to Congress, is fighting back.
The Bolivian political system is changing from one dominated by the descendants of Europeans to one where the indigenous majority has true power for the first time.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. 150 top Pentagon officials, nuclear scientists, and weapons contractors are meeting behind closed doors today in a top-secret meeting to discuss rewriting the country's nuclear strategy. Congressional observers have been barred from attending. Some observers fear the attendees will agree to end the U.S. moratorium on nuclear testing and launch a new generation of nuclear weapons. The meeting's taking place at the Offutt Military Base, also known as U.S. Strategic Command, outside of Omaha, Nebraska. The Guardian of London notes many ironies of the meeting's location and timing. The Offutt site inspired the setting for the 1964 film Dr. Strangelove. Those attending the meeting arrived last night on the anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima 58 years ago. Some are expected to stay until Saturday, the anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb on Nagasaki. The B-29 planes which dropped those nuclear bombs, the Enola Gay and Boxcar, were both built at the base. The Guardian writes, quote, "The use of those weapons marked the beginning of the Cold War and the first nuclear age. Today's meeting, many observers believe, could mark the start of a second." Protests outside the base took place over the weekend and are resuming. The protests, among them of the protesters, are Father Frank Cordero of the Des Moines Catholic Worker Movement. He joins us on the phone right now. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Father Frank Cordero.
Good morning, Amy.
Can you tell us what's happened there, how the protests were yesterday before you begin today's protests?
Well, this is something we've been doing for over 20 years, marking the anniversary of the August 6th and 9th bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki with demonstrations and protests. Recent years, the protest has taken the form of a three-and-a-half-day vigil outside the gate, 12 hours a day on the 6th, the 7th, the 8th, starting at 8 a.m. when the bomb dropped on Hiroshima, and ending on Saturday, this Saturday, the 9th, at 11 a.m. when the bomb was dropped on Nagasaki.
Is there any indication that among the participants in the meeting that there are some who are disturbed or worried about the deliberations that are going on?
Oh, there's no indication of anything from the people who are participating in the meeting at the base. We never see them. I don't even think there's a list of these folks. We hear that the vice president's going to be there, and sometimes we don't. It's a very secretive thing. So there's absolutely, to our knowledge, no connection between their reality and our reality on the streets at the gate remembering Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
And how many are protesting outside, Frank?
Pardon me?
How many are protesting outside?
Well, we reached the double digits yesterday, so that means we had up to 10 folks. It's always a very small and faithful crowd that hangs around at this place. during these days and these recent times.
Father Frank Cordero, I want to thank you for being with us of the Des Moines Catholic Worker. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we continue with news from Baghdad, up to 10 people have died after a car bomb exploded outside the Jordanian embassy there today. Another 40 were injured. Meanwhile, two U.S. soldiers died last night in separate firefights in Baghdad. The New York Times reports the U.S. plans to scale back the number of house raids in Iraq because the raids are turning the population against U.S. troops. Israel yesterday freed nearly 340 Palestinian prisoners in a move hailed by Prime Minister Ariel Sharon as a sign that Israel is committed to peace. But the Guardian of London reports the Palestinian leadership dismissed the move as a public relations ploy. Most of the freed men were within months, weeks, and days of being released. The California gubernatorial race yesterday got a lot more crowded. Arnold Schwarzenegger, the star of films such as The Terminator and Conan the Barbarian, announced he will run as a Republican. Political pundit and columnist Arianna Huffington threw her hat in the ring. So Lieutenant Governor Cruz Bustamante and child acting star Gary Coleman of Different Strokes are also running. Earlier in the week, Larry Flint, the publisher of Hustler, said he too would run. Over 200 people have now taken out papers to replace Governor Gray Davis if voters recall him in October. If Schwarzenegger wins, he would become the second actor elected governor in California. The first was Ronald Reagan. An Indonesian court today sentenced Amrozi bin Nurhazim to death by firing squad after he was found guilty of helping orchestrate last year's bombing in Bali that killed more than 200 people. Meanwhile, the death toll of Tuesday's bombing outside the Marriott Hotel in Jakarta has risen to 14. New York Daily News is reporting that Attorney General John Ashcroft will soon go on a 10-day, 20-state campaign to garner support to expand his power in the so-called war on terror and the war on drugs. The Daily News reports the campaign will be known as the Victory Tour because Ashcroft will be pushing for passage of the Victory Act, which stands for the Vital Interdiction of Criminal Terrorist Organizations Act. The new legislation will allow the government to obtain private business records of people, increase surveillance of wireless communications, among other things. In a setback to Congressman Richard Gephardt, the AFL-CIO has decided to wait until mid-October before endorsing a Democratic candidate for president. Gephardt already has the backing of the Teamsters. He hoped an AFL-CIO endorsement would provide a much-needed push in his campaign. In related news, former New York Governor Mario Cuomo is calling on Al Gore to enter the race. Gore is speaking in New York today in a forum sponsored by the anti-war group MoveOn.org. Secretary of State General Colin Powell has recommended the U.S. resume its role in tracking and sometimes shooting down suspected drug trafficking planes in Colombia. The U.S. stopped its involvement 2 years ago when a U.S. missionary and her baby were killed when their plan was mistakenly shot down over Peru. Bishops from the Episcopal Church yesterday rejected a proposal to create new ceremonies to celebrate same-sex unions. In Texas, the planned execution of Jose Rivera was stopped by a federal appeals court last night, 3 hours after he was scheduled to die. The prosecutor's chief witness said Rivera did not commit the murder he was convicted of. And his attorney said Rivera cannot be legally executed because he is mentally retarded. And the Republican governor of South Dakota has decided the state will not celebrate G. Gordon Liddy Day. The governor said his office accidentally signed off on a proclamation for today to honor Liddy, who spent 4.5 years in jail for his role in breaking into the Democratic Party national headquarters located at the Watergate complex in 1972. After he came out of jail, he became a talk show host who called on people to shoot agents of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms if they raided their houses. Somebody's Watching Me, Rockwell, and Michael Jackson, the chorus. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. This is Democracy Now!
And good day to all of our listeners and viewers. Well, a Florida law enforcement data sharing network is about to go national. In the name of counterterrorism, the Departments of Justice and Homeland Security are pouring millions of dollars into the system to expand it to local law enforcement agencies across the nation. It's called MATRIX, which stands for Multi-State Anti-Terrorism Information Exchange. According to the Washington Post, the computer network accesses information that has always been available to investigators, but brings it together and enables police to access it with extraordinary speed. Civil liberties and privacy groups say the MATRIX system dramatically increases the ability of local police to snoop on individuals.
What the Washington Post didn't say is who the individuals are behind the Florida company that built the database, founded by a man behind ChoicePoint and Database Technologies. Remember those companies, the companies that administered the contract that scrubbed the voter rolls of the 2000 elections, stripping many thousands of African Americans of their right to vote. Although narrower in scope than John Poindexter's controversial terrorist global information awareness program, MATRIX may serve a similar purpose because it provides unprecedented access to U.S. residents regardless of whether or not they have a criminal record. And states are eager to participate in the new program. On Tuesday, the Department of Homeland Security announced plans to launch a pilot program in state law enforcement data sharing among Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania, and New York. We're joined on the phone by Greg Palast, who's author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy and a BBC investigative reporter, and Wayne Madsen, who is senior fellow at the Electronic Information Privacy Center, that is EPIC. Well, Wayne Madsen, let's begin with you. This MATRIX system, how did the Washington Post put it? Says, organizers say the system, dubbed MATRIX, enables investigators to find patterns and links among people and events faster than ever before, combining police records with commercially available collections of personal information about most American adults. It would let authorities, for instance, instantly find the name and address of every brown-haired owner of a red Ford pickup truck in a 20-mile radius of a suspicious event. Wayne, can you tell us about this?
Well, this system, as it's described, would be the mother of all fishing nets. When we talk about people that go on fishing expeditions, this is exactly what people have complained about, where the technology was heading. And the mere fact that we know there's been past abuses of criminal information databases by law enforcement, for example, the National Crime Information Center, many investigations by the General Accounting Office found out that cops were using this system to help their buddies who were private investigators, help girlfriends, track down different people and, find out various spouses who were they cheating with. So that the abuses have been great with these types of systems, and we hear about all the technology, but we don't hear anything about any sort of legislation to curb abuses, to put the brakes on how this type of information will be used. So we just see this windfall of billions of dollars for Homeland Security, and now it's going into the pocket of every con artist that comes along with the system.
Well, what about the argument of law enforcement officials that given the increasing dangers of terrorist attacks and the need for law enforcement to act with speed, that this is necessary in the environment that we're living in these days?
Well, one of the things, there actually has been a system that has done this sort of information sharing between state, local, and federal law enforcement agencies. It's called the Regional Information Sharing System Network, or RISNET. And you have to wonder, how many systems do these people actually need? We had Poindexter at the Pentagon with his system, the Total Information Awareness. The police already have a system. They've used the RISNET to warn police departments in cities about the anti-war demonstrators that were leaving their jurisdiction and heading by plane or bus or car to areas where there were anti-war demonstrations. So they've used this system. It's just the question is how many more of these systems do they need, and when is somebody in Congress or state legislature is going to say enough is enough.
We've just been joined by Phil Raymer, who's special agent in charge of Florida's statewide intelligence at the Department of Law Enforcement there. You're quoted in the Washington Post as saying that the possible abuses in the system are scary.
That's correct. And what I was trying to be is realistic. When you look at the information when you first call it up, there's never been an application that I've seen that would give you that much information at one time. It can look scary. But the facts are, all the information in the system is public information that's already available to law enforcement. It's just not available in one place with one query in the way that it is in this system.
But isn't this, Wayne Mattson, part of the concern that civil liberties groups have always had with these massive computer databases, that yes, they're public records, but put them all together and you get a frightening ability to be able to call up information on any particular individual in the society?
Absolutely, and actually this was something Admiral Poindexter argued about when he was National Security Advisor under President Reagan. He tried to implement a new security classification called unclassified but sensitive, because he said if you put together a lot of unclassified information that was available publicly, it could become classified information. So the intelligence agencies have always argued that this is a problem, and I would suggest that privacy advocates can use the same argument used by the CIA and the National Security Council when they've said that this is an issue for them, that when you put together a lot of information from public sources, it goes to the next level and becomes much more sensitive. And certainly what we see with Matrix and these other systems, that seems to be the case as well.
Well, Phil Raymer of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, can you tell us how it works, how you're going to use this?
Yeah, it's very simple. What we've done is we've taken data that's available from companies that you can go contract with now. Sizen has a product called Accurant. There's a ChoicePoint, LexisNexis, others out there, where I can go and get information, or I can just go to Google on the Internet and get lots of information about any particular individual. What we've done is we've taken other public data that's restricted in nature, like driver's license data, criminal history data, and we've made it so you can search against both things at one time. And what it does is give police the power to make one search and get all the information. For instance, if I'm looking for a person who committed a crime a number of years ago and I run their criminal history record, what I will find now in the police system is, first, I'll have to go to 50 different states to do the search. Second, I'll find their address that the police knew about back when they were arrested, which was 10 years ago, could be very old. By combining both systems, I can find not only who the person is, but I could also find their current address. And it just simply saves law enforcement and investigative analysts a tremendous amount of time in doing research. It's information they would eventually get to anyhow, and that's the point that I make with everybody. We would eventually have the information. It's just that this cuts down the time, and to me it's no different than automating any system out there and making it a lot more user-friendly and the information much more timely. And in the days that we live in today, when things change so quickly, I just think we have to have this technology and use it in a very smart way, in a very restrictive way. You ask another question about how are we going to restrict it. Right now, it's restricted to only criminal investigations. You know, people have to go through a training session that says they understand that. They have to sign an agreement that says they understand that. And then we audit the system. Just like any law enforcement system, if we find someone abusing it, we cut them off, and sometimes we've even prosecuted people for that.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. You are listening to Democracy Now! We're talking about a new database, and we're talking with the people who will be using this database. On the line with us is Phil Raymer, who is with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. Also, Wayne Mattson, senior fellow at the Electronic Privacy Information Center. We'll be back also with Greg Pallast, author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. And we're going to talk about who is behind this particular database. What is Sisent Technologies? Stay with us. Thank you. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Coming up, we're going to be going to Afghanistan to look at the country almost 2 years later. Women are going back to try to have input in the Afghan constitution at the same time. The rise of warlords, both Taliban and Northern Alliance warlords running the country. But we're talking about a new database called the Matrix that will combine commercial as well as government databases on people. And we're talking to Wayne Madsen, senior fellow at the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Also joining us on the line is Phil Raymer. He is with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. Also joining us, Greg Pallast, who is the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. The company that has put forward this database, actually given it to the state of Florida, is Sisint Inc. Sisint Inc. is founded by Hank Asher, who also founded Database Technologies in 1992, which later merged with ChoicePoint, which was sued by the NAACP and other organizations for the scrubbing of the voter rolls in the 2000 election. Greg Pallast, can you piece this all together for us?
Yeah, well, Amy and Juan, it's deja vu all over again. I can't believe it. My good friend Hank Asher is back with another alias. This one is Sisint. For those who've read my book or Michael Moore's book, Database Technologies, his old company, is the organization that came up with a list. Now it's up to 97,000 names of supposed felons in Florida who were scrubbed off the voter rolls before the presidential election. It turns out almost every name on that list was an innocent person. They were named as felons by this company, by Hank Asher's company. They were named as felons. They weren't felons. They lost their vote, and surprise, most of them were African Americans. And that fixed our election. So Hank is back. Now, Hank was thrown off the board of the company he founded by the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency because of his connections to Bahamian drug dealers. They said, if that guy is on, we don't want anything to do with him because of his connections. So here he is, back with a different costume on, and up to the same tricks. First, he's such a wonderful guy, and of course, the first thing he's doing is jumping on the September 11th War on Terror bandwagon to see if he can, you know, suck a few bucks out of that one, too. So the first thing he's doing is giving away supposedly free software. That's exactly what his last company did with Database Technologies to scrub the voter rolls. I'll give you a little software, and what this does is it gives the law enforcement agencies their first free information heroin fix. So they are now spending millions of dollars in staff time and equipment to run this software, and then he's got them. There's nowhere else to go. Note that there's no bidding for this. Of all the people on this planet to put in charge of minding these very sensitive databases about who is a terrorist and who isn't, I mean, Hank Asher would be at the bottom of my list. It's true, he's above Osama, maybe, but not far. You've got, and this is one of the big problems. Before, you also had this company. I know we have obviously an upstanding guy from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. Let's not forget that Hank Asher's company was found to have completely misused the information from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. They took the tapes from what's called the FDLE, which are, by the way, riddled with endless amounts of errors. And shouldn't be used for such very sensitive things as this. It's riddled with errors. They used this information, misused it, and created a list of basically Democrats and black people to eliminate from the voter rolls. Now, you have to understand that Hank Asher's company, last company, knew exactly what they were doing, knew that the state of Florida Republican leadership, that's Catherine Harris, Jeb Bush, and before Harris was a Republican Secretary of State named Sandra Morthamp. And Database Technologies, according to internal memos and by the confession of the company executives in the NAACP suit, they knew that their information was being misused by the politicians to knock off black voters off the voter rolls. And that is another reason why they're using an outside contractor. You get a politically amenable guy like Hank Asher, who for a few bucks to line his pocket will do what the politicians want.
Well, I'd like to ask Phil.
That I would trust to make sure that not only is our data secure,
but in fact that the work is being done properly. I mean, don't.
Well, Greg, let me bring in.
They are incompetent.
Greg, let me bring in here Phil Raymer, special agent in charge of statewide intelligence at Florida Department of Law Enforcement. Your response, you know about the history of what happened with the Florida election and that individuals who were involved in that fiasco would now be in charge of this even larger national effort here?
I don't think Hank Asher was involved in that. I think that he was out of that company when the elections issue came up in Florida, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not exactly, because I haven't tracked this.
Unfortunately, he was there till 99, and the big fix was done in 98 and 99 before he left.
Okay, but you may be correct. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But one of the things, but he does bring up a good point, and I'll, one of the things we tell people when you use this system, don't do anything, don't react to anything until you get the original document that supports it, because this is a combination of public data that people have inputted in computers. People can make mistakes in it, and then that's one of the ground rule things that we tell people. Go if you find something in the system that you think is important, you go back to the original data source before you take any action. In fact, we even have a little pop-up screen that reminds them of that when they sign on, because it is a computation of other people's data, and there can be mistakes in it. And so it's used to help you find that original document. But that is a good point, and we're very, very concerned about that.
Well, one thing I'm very concerned about, this is Greg again, yeah, is that we do know that, once again, we have a no-bid contract. We have a company that's wheedling its way in, and now we'll have a lock on this national system. We know before that this was another trick that Asher used. He hired up a guy from law enforcement in Florida, George Bruder, to run the database technologies operation, the scrub operation. And this is a very politically connected operation. I'm very concerned about that. Is this the right guy, and is this the right operation to be running something this sensitive? No one is against law enforcement agencies sharing information. What we are doing here, though, is getting outside contractors who therefore don't have the same type of controls that we have internally within government to run the most sensitive databases. And in some cases, by the way, while information may be public, it may not necessarily be accessible by law enforcement agencies properly. Don't forget, we have something, a law that was in effect before September 11th called the United States Constitution, which said that you can't have your records reviewed, certain of your records reviewed, without a warrant from a court. What we do know is that these databases are being created, especially and specifically with private contractors, so that the Department of Homeland Security can now dip in and do what's called data mining, which is effectively warrantless, massive warrantless searches. And I'm very concerned here because let's not forget, of all the terrorist attacks we've had and of 19 hijackers that attacked us on September 11th, 2001, not one was an American citizen. And now we're creating this massive database in which American citizens have gone from being the victims to being the suspects. And we better pull back here, and especially when we got politically connected guys who have misused their list, not taking care of private data, like Hank Asher and his crowd out of Boca Raton, I get very nervous. This is exactly the type of crew that we wanted to keep away from these databases. I mean, you couldn't come up with a worse team.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Greg Palast is the author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, where he details what Choice Point and DataPace technologies were involved with in the 2000 election. We've also been joined by Phil Raymer. Phil Raymer is the head of intelligence, special agent in charge of statewide intelligence in Florida, and Wayne Madsen of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, known as EPIC. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we move on now to another story, and it is what is taking place now in Afghanistan. Very serious developments there in, well, almost 2 years since the U.S. began bombing Afghanistan. The Taliban are back. The suppression of women is increasing. The drug market is flourishing. Today, we're going to go back. The Taliban stepping up attacks on U.S. and coalition forces as Afghan citizens continue to be victims of violence. According to the Washington Post, just over the border border in the town of Chaman, Pakistan, Taliban officials are organizing by having open meetings and handing out guns, money, and motorbikes in exchange for planting landmines and bombs in Afghanistan. Warlords also continue to dominate much of Kandahar, and the illegal drug trade is flourishing.
A report recently released by Human Rights Watch describes evidence of human rights violations by the U.S.-supported government officials. In southeast Afghanistan, observers note army and police troops kidnapping Afghans and holding them for ransom in unofficial prisons. Police forces break into households and rob families. They extort shopkeepers, bus, truck, and taxi drivers. There have been arbitrary arrests of journalists and death threats to media editors by local officials, army, police, and intelligence agents. Political dissidents have also been subject to random detentions. In parts of Kabul city, the report states that women, girls, and boys are abducted in broad daylight outside of their homes and on their way to school. Women and girls have been raped in their homes in the evenings and during armed robberies. The mounting instability comes as the country prepares for a nationwide debate on the new constitution. Representatives for the Loya Jirga, or Grand Council, are expected to convene in October for a constitutional convention.
Democracy Now! Listeners and viewers may remember the story of Masuda Soltan. She was living in New York at the time of the September 11th attacks and traveled back to Afghanistan a few months later with filmmaker John Alpert. There she learned that the U.S. military had bombed and killed 19 members of her family. She's currently traveling back to Afghanistan to gain an understanding of the current situation as a member of a new organization called Women for Afghan Women, and wants to be a part of the writing of that constitution along with other women. She joins us in the studio just before she leaves. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Masuda.
Thank you for having me on again.
It's good to have you with us. We're also joined on the phone by Ann Brodsky, who is author of a new book called With All Our Strength, The Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, and hope to speak with Fariba Nawa, who is a freelance reporter in Afghanistan now. Talk about why you're going back. You're going to Kandahar, a very dangerous place right now.
Well, I have been working with Women for Afghan Women, advocating for women's rights in Afghanistan and the inclusion of women in all of the reconstruction processes, political, economic, social, etc. I was in Afghanistan in March for International Women's Day and found that it was celebrated by the Women's Ministry in Kabul with full security, and went outside of Kabul and found that women celebrating International Women's Day in Afghanistan is a pretty sad thing, because there's not much that has changed since the fall of the Taliban for women outside of Kabul especially. So I'm going back to gather women from all over the country, from the provinces, from the countryside, from Kabul, in Kandahar. And we felt that it was very important to go to Kandahar because, as you may know, most of the international agencies, international peacekeepers, all of the Western sort of NGOs are focused on Kabul because they cannot go outside and they're afraid to take that risk. And our conference, our third annual conference, is a statement to say we are going to expand the focus, not only to Kabul, but we want to say Kandahar is a place that needs attention. It's the second largest city in the country. It was a former stronghold of the Taliban, so we thought it would be a real statement to have it there. And what we'll do there is get, like I said, women will come together. The draft of the constitution should be released by September 1st. It's been delayed, and that's of concern, something I can get into later. But by then, the draft will have been released, and the women will gather and look at the draft and look at the language concerning women and look at constitutions from other countries and make recommendations and changes and then present to the Constitutional Commission, to the President, and to the international community. So that's the main focus of the conference. We'll also look at elections, and we'll have members of the Election Commission there to help figure out how will women be enabled, what will the circumstances be, what will be done to ensure their participation in the upcoming elections in June of 2004.
But much was made when the U.S. Declared war and went into Afghanistan about the liberation of women that would occur. And you're saying that outside of Kabul, basically, that very little has changed. Is that because of problems within the existing government as well as the Taliban, or is it just because they haven't been able to control the countryside yet of Taliban supporters?
I think that the problem is attributable to a number of different factors. The main factor that women and Afghan men and most people who have traveled there cite is security. There simply is not the environment for a woman to be able to go out. I was in Kandahar. I met a woman who was working with an NGO doing hygiene classes out in the villages, and she said she needed to work. And she had no choice, but she said if she didn't, she would rather stay home. She said, every day that I leave my house, I'm worried that someone's going to come into my house and basically abduct or rape her daughters because of what she's doing. So the threat, the fear, is really what's preventing them. And it's fear that's caused by the local, you know, the local warlords, local police. And it, you know, as we all know, there are warlords in the government. And so women see that, and I don't understand how they're expected to come out and risk their lives in that environment.
Hmm. We're joined also on the phone by Fariba Nawa, who is an independent reporter who has been investigating the drug trade in Afghanistan. Can you talk about what you have found, Fariba?
Hi, I'm in the western city of Herat right now, and the drug trade is probably the biggest business in Afghanistan. It's about 40% of the GDP, and most, I would say, many of the warlords who are in power right now have a hand in it. I've been working on a project for 3 weeks now, and basically, during the Taliban time, the drug trade was pretty much open until 2000 when they banned cultivation. But what I'm doing is working on the trafficking end. This is, most of the drugs are grown in the south and the east, and then they come through here and go to Iran, where it is transported to Turkey and then turned into heroin, and it feeds about 90% of Europe's and the world's drug demand. So Afghanistan right now is if you ask what it's known for, it's for the drug trade. And eradication efforts have been really unsuccessful. The British have taken the lead on it, and they've tried to compensate farmers. But the latest controversy right now is that there are witnesses saying that they're spraying fields of opium to try to get rid of the cultivation, and that's against international law right now. But the officials deny it. So I'm trying to look into certain accusations, and it's a bit difficult because, as you know, this is somewhat of a dangerous assignment, and everywhere I go, I tend to be a little conspicuous, a woman coming from the West and investigating, even though I wear the necessary clothing. It's been a bit difficult. But I'm also focusing on women and what they've been through. There are hundreds, and I would exaggerate to say maybe thousands of women, I don't know the numbers, of widows who've lost their husbands and sons traveling, who are traffickers and are shot by the Iranian government or the Turkmenistan government, which are the two borders here, when they try to smuggle these drugs out of here.
The first page of a Human Rights Watch report, the first sentence says, Afghan warlords and political strongmen supported by the United States and other nations are engendering a climate of fear in Afghanistan, threatening efforts to adopt a new constitution that could derail national elections scheduled for mid-2004. What about the role of the United States, Fariba Nawa, what you see on the ground in Afghanistan with these warlords?
I'm from the city where I'm right now. Ismail Khan is a very powerful leader. He basically controls the West. President Hamid Karzai has tried to minimize his power, and it has not been successful. The Americans have a base here. They're about, I think they're special forces and civil affairs officers, but you hardly see them. They're not very visible like they may be in Kandahar or Kabul. They sort of stay to themselves, and they're pulling out. As far as I know, the coalition forces are pulling out. The only soldiers staying here, the troops, are the civilian affairs officers, the ones who are working on reconstruction projects, because they see no need for safety and and stability. Herat is very safe. It's probably the safest area in terms of, if there's a dictatorship here. Ismail Khan says, you stay out of my way, I stay out of yours. But if you say anything against me, then you will be punished. That's how it works out here. And basically, the central government has no say, for the most part, in what goes on here. And neither do the Americans. But he's able, he's a very good politician in that he's able to work Iran, the United States, and the central government. He somehow makes them all keep him in power. I mean, if the U.S. really wanted to, they could kick Ismail Khan out, but they don't because he gives them intelligence information about the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. So that's what's happening out here. As far as the rest of the country is concerned, I'm sure that your listeners are aware that the resistance movement is getting stronger. And it's not just one, I wouldn't say it's just the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. There are a lot of discontent individuals in Afghanistan who are seeing that the United States is not living up to its bargain.
Well, if I can, I'd like to bring in also Anne Brodsky. She's the author of With All Our Strength, the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. She's joining us by telephone. And I would like to ask you, in terms of the chaotic situation in Afghanistan, could you tell us how the women's organizations there have managed to persevere and continue to struggle to achieve some measure of dignity in their rights?
Well, that really is a remarkable part of this story. I was just back in Afghanistan a month ago, and it's clear that women continue to have to fight for even the most basic rights. And while Kabul is better than the rest of the country, women's freedoms there are really quite minimal. And as I describe in the book, the struggle for women's rights has been ongoing for centuries in Afghanistan, but the past 24 years or so have really seen the most marked threat to women and a backslide caused by a succession of brutal regimes from the Soviet invasion through the jihadis, the Taliban, and now. And it's this context, as well as the crimes that are documented by Human Rights Watch and reported to me last month that are ongoing, that explain why the women don't feel liberated or secure, and why underground organizations for women like RAWA continue to be a necessity. Women are still being educated. Women and girls are still in secret classes of RAWA. The classes themselves might not be secret from the family, but the fact that the RAWA classes is because there's thousands and thousands of girls who aren't allowed to go back to school because it's too dangerous, or there's not a school available in their neighborhood, or they're too old to go back, or they've been married, perhaps even by force, under the Taliban, and so they're not eligible to be in the government schools. Healthcare, basic supplies, income-generating, all of those sorts of necessities of life are still having to be provided by organizations like RAWA and by women on the ground because international aid isn't reaching the people, and the government at this point is both corrupt because of the warlords and also still unorganized and insecure itself, and so unable to provide for the people, even those members of the government who would want to.
Masouda Soltan, as we wrap up, you head to Afghanistan. We'll follow you there, talk to you when you're there. How do you expect to get women's voices into the writing of this constitution?
Well, women's rights in Afghanistan have to be phrased within an Islamic context. It's sort of the only strategy that women have told us will work. And what part of what this conference is going to do is to develop a common language with these women to solidify their arguments so that, and I was told by someone working very closely with the Constitutional Commission that at the Constitutional Lawyer Jirga, women will have to be on the same page, making the arguments in a solid way, meaning they all have to agree on the language, because the lawyer jirga is going to be taped, and that recording is going to be used to determine law in the country in the future. They're going to look at it when there are disagreements or misunderstandings, or to gain clarification about what they meant. So it's really important that women are on the same page. The other thing with our conference is that it's not just women that we know as human rights leaders in Afghanistan, not the typical people you hear about, but also women who are uneducated, women who are from the provinces, women who we have never heard from before, and who face a very different reality from that we often, you know, hear about in Kabul. So the other thing I wanted to say in terms of the U.S. role is the amount of aid going to Afghanistan, and security was one issue, but there simply isn't enough money going to the right places in Afghanistan. If you look at East Timor, Rwanda, Bosnia, there's an average of like $250 per head, and in Afghanistan it's $75 per head. And you just wonder why the United States is not investing in Afghanistan if it really means business.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. Masuda Sultan is with Women for Afghan Women. Your website?
womenforafghanwomen.org, womenforafghanwomen.org. Thank you.
Also on the line with us, Anne Brodsky, author of With All Our Strength, The Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, a new book. And joining us on the line from Afghanistan, Fariba Nawa, freelance journalist investigating the drug trade there. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to Bolivia. We'll be joined by John Alpert, filmmaker, has a new film on Bolivia that will be shown tonight on PBS. John also was with Masuda Sultan when she returned to Afghanistan after September 11th. Stay with us.
Me quieren agitar.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Bolivia's embattled president, Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, who secured a majority coalition in Congress on Tuesday. The alliance with the New Republic Force, one of the biggest opposition groups, gives the ruling coalition enough votes to pass most laws and approve state appointments. Bolivia is the world's third biggest producer of coca, the leaf used to make cocaine. Pressured by the U.S., the white-dominated Bolivian government has declared war on coca and the people who grow it, known as the cocaleros. Two-thirds of Bolivia's population is indigenous.
Bolivian governments since the 1990s have hacked down and uprooted thousands of acres of coca plants, mostly in the Chapare region. In 1997, Evo Morales was the first cocalero elected to Congress. Morales is the leader of the Movement Toward Socialism Party. He organized blockades and closed highways to protest government policies toward coca growers, winning concessions from the government. In January 2002, the white dominated Congress expelled Evo. He ran for president a year ago, coming in second, just 1% behind the winner. He remains the most powerful opposition leader in Bolivia.
We broadcast on public access TV and satellite television on Dish Network, Free Speech TV, which is channel 9415, and public access TV stations around the country who can now look at Juan. In his traditional Bolivian hat, John Alpert has just put it on his head. He is
with
a filmmaker who's returned.
The coca tea ear product from Bolivia that John has also supplied for us.
Has just returned from Bolivia along with Matt O'Neill, and they have made a film that will be airing tonight on PBS on Bolivia called Coca and the Congressman. But why don't we start with a clip from the film that goes right to that congressman, the man who could be president of Bolivia.
In the Quechua and Aymara culture, in the Andean culture, above all, I'm serving the people. The power has to remain with the people. If we don't resolve the economic, social, and cultural problems of the Quechua, Aymara, and Guaynari, we're never going to resolve the problems in this country. For this reason, I'm convinced that we have to create a new state. I'm convinced that capitalism is the worst enemy of humanity and the environment, the enemy of the entire planet.
Thank you, Evo Morales. Any last words?
In 1997, we appeared with only 1% support. Then we rose to 3%. We tripled. Last year, the poll said we only had 6 or 8% support, but we rose to 20%, and the journalists, who are enemies to our social movement, now say that we have 39%. We can create a new nation where there's justice and equality. Thank you very much.
Evo Morales, John Alpert described this scene where you were in Bolivia.
Well, we spent a week following Evo around. We actually got there during a week he was organizing a Youth Olympics. He's doing very interesting grassroots politicking. In this region, the people are very poor. They're people who grow coca. If you grow coca and you sell it illegally, you might be able to make $2,500 a year, and that's a living wage for peasants. If you don't grow coca and the government comes and takes your plants out, you make 75 cents a day and your family starves. He collected all the youth from this particular region, brought them together in an athletic competition. It was very clever because these are his supporters of the future, and they loved it. Many of these kids had never been away from home before. And to see somebody like Evo, who was their hero, who rose from the farms and who is now in Congress, almost became president, shaking hands with them, tasting the soup, visiting the grandmothers, it was like Chicago politicking, and it's working.
Quite a difference from another indigenous leader, Toledo, over in Peru, who's had quite a different trajectory and actually is, I think, more unpopular right now than it kind of polls than any leader in the Western Hemisphere.
Well, Bolivia is polarized. They have a small white minority that has controlled the economy and has controlled politics there. I mean,
you also interviewed the president of Bolivia.
He's a very nice guy who. You know, you're almost confused when you talk to him because he seems more American than we felt. He went to school in the United States, went to college at the University of Chicago, speaks Spanish with a very distinct Spanish accent, and I think is quite well-intentioned, but doesn't look anything like the majority of people in the country. And for decades, there wasn't even a single indigenous representative in the Bolivian Congress. And when Evo came in, I mean, that was the beginning of the revolution.
Can you talk about the crackdown on the coca growers, Matt O'Neill?
The crackdown on coca growing in Bolivia has been going on since the late 80s, and it got especially difficult in the late 90s under the Banzer administration, the former dictator who was elected president. And that's really what launched Evo Morales into the popular consciousness in Bolivia, because he was seen as an indigenous leader, a leader fighting against the imperial wishes of the American embassy in destroying the coca leaf, and fighting for the campesinos whose only choice to live was by growing coca.
We're joined on the phone from Cochabamba by Catherine Lediber, who is director of the Andean Information Network with the Washington Office on Latin America, a consultant as well. You are looking at the laws that are being pushed by Bolivia cracking down on coca growers. Catherine.
Yes, that's correct. What we've seen since the late 80s is a very, very strong legal movement, and in terms of policy, to put the squeeze on coca growers who are, you know, poor peasant farmers that have borne the brunt of these programs, beginning with Law 1008 and following through with Plan Dignidad. What we've seen is there's been increasing pressure on the coca growers, a militarization of the eradication process, which has directly inserted the Bolivian military into anti-drug efforts in Bolivia, which has provoked a great deal of violence and repression in the region as well.
And to what degree has there been attempts by Bolivian government or by the United States to induce crop substitution and to financially back a change in cultivation?
Well, Law 1008, the anti-drug law passed in 1988 with strong U.S. pressure, mandates simultaneous alternative development efforts. Unfortunately, these programs since the late 80s have been very poorly implemented, poorly focused, have not worked directly with the coca grower family or the beneficiaries, and in fact have created parallel associations that divide the community there. Unfortunately, as there's been massive eradication, there have not been products or programs that have been able to replace that income. And since the beginning of massive forced eradication in 1997, we have seen a huge increase in infant mortality and malnutrition throughout that region.
John, you visited a prison in Bolivia. Many people are being held.
It's a prison specifically for people who violate the narcotics laws, financed by the United States.
Or who are suspected of.
Yeah, there's the law that Catherine's talking about presumes that you're guilty if they catch you or suspect that you're involved with narcotics. It's the only law in the Bolivian Constitution that allows you to be detained under those circumstances. There's a war going on. It's a war against drugs. I mean, I don't think anybody likes having cocaine come into the United States, but until they give the peasants an alternative, AVO will be their champion and they'll be fighting against the eradication.
Tonight, the PBS documentary Coca and the Congressman airs around the country at 9?
At 9 o'clock, so everybody stay home. There's nothing else to do except watch this program. Listen, Bolivia is part of our hemisphere. We really, most Americans, don't know very much about what's going on down there. This is a good opportunity to see something.
John Alpert, longtime award-winning filmmaker, and Matt O'Neill have just come back from Bolivia. Their film, Coca and the Congressman, airing tonight on PBS. Thank you very much. Also to Catherine Lederberg, who's with the Andean Information Network in Bolivia. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a video or audio copy of the program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is www.democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Lenina Nadal, Anna Nogueira, Elizabeth Press, Olpa Patel, Nell Geiser, and Chris Abrams. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!